So warm welcome to everyone. I hope people enjoyed this magnificent day, and we have a full moon tonight. So I have an interest in somatic experiences, so let's do a little bit of that. Just come into the body, maybe. I know some of you have been sitting, but just to feel the support of the cushion or chair, bench underneath you. And just let the energy come down into the heart, into the belly area. So I find this, forming the intention to do this on an ongoing basis really makes it possible to listen more carefully, not to be so reactive going up to all your responses, but to really be intimate with yourself and with other people. The title of the talk is Mindfulness Not Enough. I was very tempted to use a line from Ajahn Suchito, who's one of my favorite teachers, that he wrote in a blog, "Mindfulness is overrated." But I didn't have enough chutzpah, or maybe I had too much wisdom. I'm not sure which to do that. So mindfulness is a word that I've actually obsessed about for a long, long time, and I hope this talk doesn't get too obsessive. But now we're supposed to be doing mindfulness practice, and what does that mean, what we're supposed to do? And what do I mean by it not being enough? That's what I want to talk about. And I hope to keep this relatively brief because I want to maybe do a little exercise at the end. I'd start by reading two definitions of mindfulness and recognizing that no one sentence definition is going to really provide enough subtlety to what the word means, but as a start. So Jon Kabat-Zinn, who many of you probably know, and maybe even some of you have taken some of his mindfulness-based stress reduction classes, really took this practice of mindfulness out of the Buddhist tradition, took a lot of the Buddhist teachings and dropped those and used it to first dealing with chronic pain, which was really apparently very helpful without empirical evidence for it. And then we had mindfulness-based stress reduction, and we got mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and then we got mindfulness to be a better business person, mindfulness to be a better lover, mindfulness to be another sniper. Now, I'm not saying that he took the ethics out, but really that's what's happened to a lot of it. And a lot of other things that are in the Buddhist tradition, what we're talking about mindfulness, really is not in what has evolved out of Jon Kabat-Zinn's efforts. So I thought I'd read his definition first, and he's used some pretty wild ones in Oprah Winfrey. This is one of his more tame, direct ones. Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So as I went down during the break to go to the bathroom, and I noticed there's a sign on the banister. It said, "Please use mindfulness, caution, and the handrail on the way down the stairs." So I was thinking to myself, well, I wonder what that does to people, right? What does that word convey? And if we take Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition, to pay attention means to focus on something. And actually, we're always paying attention. A lot of times it's not conscious, but there's always some sort of knowing quality going on. So what's different here is he's saying in a particular way. What he means by a particular way, I'm not going to take on tonight, because I want to move into a more Buddhist way of looking at things. One purpose. So you're going down the stairs, you're really paying attention a particular way. Particular way, for the sign says, to be cautious. And it also says, well, maybe it implies that keep your handle on a railing. So paying attention a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Now, I find this in the present moment kind of a strange phrase, but Andy uses the same one. Like, when else can you pay attention? I mean, that's the only time you can, right? You can't pay attention sometime in the future or in the past. So non-judgmentally, that's a big word. What does that mean? That's a useful word, actually. The last talk I gave in the Q&A, someone said, well, I know I shouldn't be angry. That's a judgment, right? Anger's there. So simply pay attention to it in a particular way. What that particular way is, I want to explore. Does this make sense? Okay. All right, Andrew Olezensky. Andrew Olezensky is a Buddhist scholar, taught at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies for a long time, so he's particularly a scholar related to this tradition. So he says, mindfulness is awareness with attention in the present moment on purpose and with an attitude of intentional, and this is important, and with an attitude or intentional stance of non-attached equanimity. Okay, so they both say paying attention, you're focusing on something. Question is, what do you focus on? They're both saying it's on purpose because we're always paying attention. But now you're kind of being consciously paying attention, you're directing the attention. In the present moment, Andrew Olezensky, I took this from an article, if you want to Google it, it's called What Mindfulness Is, and then it's in parentheses, not. It's like a one-page article, it's on Lion's Roar. Okay. What's different is that John Kabat-Zinn uses the word judgment, and Andrew Olezensky uses the word equanimity. Now, since I want to talk about it's a Buddhist tradition, I'm not going to try and analyze what John Kabat-Zinn meant by non-judgment, without any judgment. Equanimity is a really big stance, and so is non-attachment. And clinging is like the cause of dukkha, this word that gets translated suffering, stress, dissatisfaction. So attachment means, oh, I want this pleasant state to stay forever, or I want to get rid of this pleasant state. It's saying, don't do that. And actually, equanimity is saying the same thing, because equanimity means that you're not drawn towards something or you're not pushing it away. This is a really high bar to do this. And he goes on in the article to talk about equanimity meaning that there's no craving. Now, there's this word, tanha, or the Pali word, that this root meaning is thirst, an unquenchable thirst. And it often gets translated as desire, which is problematic. Because there are desires to do things and things like that. They're wise, they're useful, beneficial. Craving is a reflex. It's not something you decide to do. You get a pain in the knee and it's like, oh, I got to get rid of this, right? It just happens. Okay. So, just to flesh this out some, the word mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word sati. Okay, and sati, the root meaning of it means to remember, to keep something in mind. So for example, if you're working with the breathing process, sati telling you to keep coming back. Every time you get lost, remember to come back to the breathing process. What I'm going to say next is some excerpts from a Buddhist scholar that Joseph Goldstein quotes. It says, mindfulness is knowing what we are doing when we're doing it. Take your hand and go like this. You know you're doing it, right? Okay. But there's a lot of times we don't know what we're doing. Maybe you're eating a meal and you're thinking about something else and you don't even know you're eating, right? And he's saying, not forgetting, and this is the notion of memory, not forgetting the present moment experience, to know what's going on right now. And by the way, that in these definitions about paying attention to present moment, what Andy's saying is that we're always paying attention to present moment. What the present moment means is that we know we're paying attention. We know we're having a sense experience. We know we're having thoughts. We know we're having emotions. And that's actually pretty helpful. Just this very simple ability to step back and not be lost in the emotion, the thought, the sense experience, but to be step back and be aware of it. So it's often described as the observing quality of mind. So that kind of has a notion of visual type sort of thing, right? You're stepping back and you're watching things. Now, what are you watching? Well, it isn't really, it's a little problematic using the word observing to me. There's a Zen teacher, Sabine Selassie. I don't know how to pronounce her name really. She's a black lesbian Zen teacher. And she said, mindfulness, it's a word that came to us from the Victorian era that gave us such other wonderful worlds as appreciative joy, renunciation, and then she says, ugh. It conveys being up in the head, being in the mind, observing something. And what's problematic about this, well, there's a couple of things problematic about it, is that that's one particular way of knowing what's going on. Another way is listening. So maybe you're sitting and you're practicing and there's some dialogue going on. So what's the tone of that dialogue? Is it angry, dismissive? It's really kind of a listening quality of mind. But particularly important is what's going on in the body. This is very much an embodied practice. And you know, our emotion, the body is very intelligent, and it's our ground. It's a place where we can discharge emotions. It's the place where it tells us how things feel. And out of that embodied sense, what's different is the observer. I remember when I first came to practice, I was told mindfulness, or I'm not sure whether the word was used, mindfulness or awareness, that gets tricky too. I was told it's just mirror-like. But mirror-like's not empathic. It's kind of cold. And this is really an empathic practice. It's like, how does this feel? What does this mean to me? Okay. I hope some of this is useful. I guess one way to language it is holistic. You know, it's being aware of Ajahn Sucitra uses the term holistic awareness, mindfulness of body, of heart, this felt sense, and mindfulness of mind, which could be thoughts, most conceptual things. So you want to watch all of them. Okay. So there's a discourse called the Satipatthana Sutta, which means something like the presence of mindfulness. And this discourse refers to keeping something closely in mind. So this is paying attention again, right? But it tells you what to pay attention to in particular. So one thing is to pay attention to the body. And there's a whole set of things in that category. Being aware of your postures, being aware of how you're changing your posture, being aware of the breathing process, contemplating the body parts, contemplating death. That's all the first focus or foundation of mindfulness. And it's first in a way, some ways, because it's our ground. It's the most readily available thing. Without that, we don't have steadiness. The second frame of reference is feeling tone, just where experience is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And the third is thoughts and emotions. And then the fourth is what to do about it if you can't be mindful, in a sense, part of it. So I won't talk about that part. So the Satipatthana Sutta gives us a context of where and how to observe. This is a particular way. Observe the body. Observe pleasant and unpleasant experiences. Observe thoughts and emotions. And when it says how to observe them, the language that comes with the refrain with each one of these things that gets repeated is that you're supposed to observe without greed or aversion. So this is what, I don't know if I remember to mention this, but this is what Andy Olszewski is talking about. It has an ethical quality to it. So if you have greed or aversion, then, well, you're not being mindful. What to do about it? Let's chat about that. And what you're supposed, so you're kind of not attached to things. This is Andy Olszewski's definition again. You're just observing, and what you're supposed to observe is that this stuff arises, it abides, and passes away, just like the bell I rang at the end of the sitting. And the intention behind that is to start getting some dispassion about all these things. And it takes a long time to do that, I think. I mean, I've practiced like for months at Forest Refuge, just watching things change. And it just gets to be more and more obvious. The stuff loses some of its punch. And if you're observing all this, is that what you are? What's the observer? If you can observe your body, are you body? If you can observe your mind, are you your mind? If you can observe your emotions, are you your emotions? There's no one outside of them. I remember also when I first came to practice, Thich Nhat Hanh said, not I am anger, just there is anger, that's it. Nothing, no one outside of it. And I thought, what's he talking about? But the I is an inference the mind makes. It separates us from the experience. So we're really getting into what's called samasati. Now, sama is a word that precedes each of the Eightfold Paths, which is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. And it usually gets translated as right. I don't like it. It's kind of very kind of Christian, right-wrong kind of translation. So other translations are wise. Ajahn Tanisro, who's done a lot about probably translated half the Pali text as available for us, actually implies that it might be harmonious translation. So, but samasati keeps wisdom in mind and effort to follow that wisdom. It's free of aversion, greed, and delusion to sense of a self. So if there's a sense of self, if you want something, if you want to get rid of something, you're not samasatiing. Okay. Now, I find that really tricky because, you know, if you're feeling irritated and someone says, well, you know, you're not being mindful if you're feeling irritated, that's a really high bar. But maybe you could turn your attention to the irritation. Okay. So when I say it's not enough, I mean, this is pretty good stuff. Another thing that happened to me early in my practice, well, I'd practiced here for about a year and then I did Zen for a while, and it's a wholly different approach to things. And I came back and I was told, well, you just pay bare attention. I didn't know quite what that meant, but that's some, you know. But actually I had some, you know, I hate to use the word, but some sort of realizations. I just did a kind of concentration practice. And I clearly saw not self, and you know, but I didn't really have a structure. And one day Ajahn Tanisro came here and gave a talk, and then I listened to the talk later on a CD or something. And the basis for the talk is there's an article, if you want to Google it, called "Food for Awakening." It's on Access to Insight, but you just Google "Food for Awakening," comes up. And Ajahn Tanisro likes to be provocative. So he said, the Buddha never said, pay bare attention. And yet you're going to have a lot of teachers tell you that. So then you might ask him, well, what do you mean by that? He also said that sati doesn't mean to pay attention. He says sati means to remember, to recollect. And there's a Pali word called manisikara that means attention. And there's a word, yoniso manisikara, which gets translated as sometimes appropriate attention, sometimes wise attention, sometimes fathoming attention. And that's what we're supposed to pay attention to. That's what we're supposed to do. So mindfulness keeps us to remember to pay wise attention. So then the question is, well, what is wise or appropriate attention or fathoming attention? Fathoming attention sees things in terms of wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness. So wise view is seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. It's, you know, if you're really going to, in this tradition, if you're really practicing, you have to have this view in mind. Now, I don't like noble truths either. There's a lot of other people who use the word four tasks. There are four things to do rather than four truths. Things get, like all religions, get elevated after a while. So wise view sees things in terms of Four Noble Truth. Wise intention, wise effort is activating the intention to practice with that view in mind. And wise mindfulness keeps the view and intention in mind. So it's making sure that you keep remembering, recollecting that, oh, there are these Four Noble Truths. Are you keeping that in mind as you observe what's going on? And are you acting in a way that's consistent with them? Okay. So wise view sees these tasks in terms of these Four Noble Truths. What are they? Well, there's this Pali word dukkha that usually gets translated as suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. But it's a very subtle word. But at any rate, wise view says the first thing you need to do is to see there's some suffering, stress, aversion, irritation is going on. Okay, and you're supposed to comprehend it, to understand it. Sometimes the translation is to stand under it, to bear with it. I remember when I was early in my years here, we were coming over to the Thursday morning sitting. We had coffee and had a Dharma discussion. And we got behind a garbage truck on one of those narrow roads, you know. Everybody said, welcome in dukkha. You know, because there we were stuck. We couldn't get around. We could get to the center one time. But it's that kind of thing. Actually, there's suffering stress here. Welcome in. Can I open to it? Because you can't understand it if you keep trying to get rid of it. You can't understand its cause. And that's the second part of wise, of these four tasks. So you understand that there's some form of dukkha taking place, then you look for a cause. And the Buddha says the cause, and this is back to Andy Olszewski's definition, the cause of suffering or stress is craving. This constant activity to line things up the way we want, to constantly have pleasant experiences, pleasant emotions, whatever, and get rid of all the other stuff that we don't like. So anytime you want things to be different than they are, there's a level of stress that's being created. Shinzhen Yang, who did a lot of work on pain, actually causes suffering as, resistance time pain. If you can just open to pain, there's not so much suffering. The more resistance is, the worse things get. So then the third task is to realize that there is cessation of suffering or stress as possible. This is the good news. We can actually be free from this stuff. Okay. And so then the fourth task is this path, which really consists of wisdom, ethics, important, and I guess the word usually gets used as concentration, another word I'm not too fond of, but kind of unifying the mind, I'd like to say, or calming the mind. Okay. So I want to say a little bit about this word dukkha. There's three kinds of dukkha that the Buddha talks about, most of which we could identify with being with people you don't want to be with, not being with people you want to be with, old age, sickness, death, decay, all that. That's ordinary dukkha. It's actually called dukkha-dukkha. That's the Pali word for that. And then there's the dukkha of impermanence. No matter how, and this is part why craving is a cause of dukkha, is that everything changes. You just can't line it up. And, well, to stop lining it up, you have to believe there's some other option, really, right? Because aligning it up, it is craving. You just can't always line up that pleasant, unpleasant experiences. Okay. But the third form of dukkha, I'm not going to even mention the Pali word. I've used too many already tonight. The third form of dukkha, Ajahn Sucitto talks about, is a sense of someone outside the experience. The sense of separation, that I'm angry. I'm feeling this. So you can't end the dukkha-dukkha stuff. You can't end the fact that things change. But you can end this perception, this inference that the mind makes. There's a me experiencing all this. So, for example, it appears I'm sitting up here and there are all these objects out there, beautiful objects, wonderful objects, and there's some distance between them. If I had binoculars on, the distance would be, it's just how my eyes interpret the distance, right? But the fact that I'm here observing you out there is a fabrication of mine. It's the delusion that the sense experience creates. And so practice is very much about seeing through that delusion and how that delusion gets created. So there's an inference made that I'm up here watching. But what's happening? Photons are, as best we know, photons are coming in the eyes. The mind creates an image. It's all happening on its own. No one's in there. There's no little Ron in there looking at all this stuff. Okay? Okay. I'll just say a few quick things from Ajahn Sucitto about this, what he calls fathoming attention. It's an intention to consider experience in terms of how it affects you. So you're not just observing a mirror-like. You're saying, okay, what's happening to this experience? And it's a heartful approach. It's empathic. How does this feel? Not up in the head. And rather than just, going along with the topic, you sift through the flood of interpretations and digressions, and you ask, what's the meaning behind this thought or attitude? What is the assumption, how realistic is it? I'm angry at this person because blah, 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 And we don't really know, and is it really helpful to be angry? And then do you ask you, how are you with your mind, heart, being like that? So it's a very sympathetic, not critical thing, but it's kind of exploring how to work with this stuff. That's what wise attention is. Okay, so let me give you a couple examples about how this might work, and then I want to do a little exercise. This is actually working out pretty well in terms of timing. I'm surprised. So I'm using anger because the last time I gave a talk, someone said, I know I shouldn't be angry. So you can pick your emotion, whatever difficult for you. Person said, I know I shouldn't be angry. But that's judgment, right? Mindfulness, what it does is it says, okay, this is the third foundation. There's an emotion going on here. So keep it in mind. Focus on it. Pay attention to it. What's anger like? How do you know you have anger? Or how do you know you have depression? Or how do you know whatever is going on, anxiety, fear? And this takes some skill. I talked about this a good bit last time, but and we can bring it up maybe in discussion about how I can do that, because some of the stuff can be pretty overwhelming. But what you're supposed to do is stay with it, observe its changing nature, and see that if you simply watch it, at some point it will stop. Now, you know, it might also be if you're really being empathic about it, asking questions about it, you might find underneath the anger is hurt.
Okay.
Okay. I had some examples, but I can't find them. okay. Let me give two examples. There's a guy, Sam, who's in the elders group. He's had so many difficult physical, so the elders group is 65 and older. So what we talk about, you know, we've got the old age down, we've got the sickness decay down, we're just working on a death piece now. And Sam, just, I mean, he had intestinal hemorrhages, heart problems. So one day he's not feeling quite right, and he decides to go drive himself to the hospital. And he gets there, and the surgeon says, "You're having a heart attack. Did you know that?" And he said, Sam said, "I'm not having a heart attack." I think actually maybe he said, "Who's having a heart attack?" Because he wasn't identifying with his body. And he said, "I had such immense peace." My body, but we don't get the... Are we in control of it? No. This is the Buddhist teaching. If you can't control something, don't claim it as you. Okay. Another example, I was a long, long time ago, I was on a retreat to Forest Refuge, and I had this idea that I was going to have this very concentrated sitting late in the evening, and I was just tired, and I was struggling. I mean, I just couldn't, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't, you know. And then I just realized, this is not my mind, it's not my body, I can't control it. There was such a sense of ease about that. Stepping out of the sense of identity and the idea that things should be a particular way. This is kind of the end of craving. The freedom is not having to have things a particular way. This might be what we call awakening. And maybe we can just have little moments like that. It's not like I'm awakened and you don't ever have any difficulty, but you just have more and more of it. So actually the quote, I think from Joseph Goldstein said that, when the mind is not clinging, the mind is not agitated. When the mind is not agitated, one has attained nirvana. So just one moment of not holding on to things, not trying to grab onto it, make it the way it, you know, fix it, lock into it, lock into views, opinions, whatever. When you're not doing that, there's a sense of ease. Okay. So that's kind of in a really nutshell insight meditation practice. And it's just one particular way. Right? As I said, I got a lot of insights just from concentration practice. There's some realization happened, but I did have a framework in mind. And I do find it useful. Just that, you know, there's a nice little acronym, RAIN. Some of you probably, you can Google it if you want. Recognize suffering's taking place, accept it, right? So that's the equanimity, just opening to it, allowing it to be. Accepting some people don't like because it sort of like sounds like resignation, but it's not, it's just receiving it. Or allowing it to be. And then to investigate it, which is kind of this fathoming intention or wise attention, to explore what our thoughts, how are with our thoughts and emotions? What would be a wise response to this? And then not to identify with it, which is kind of the examples I talked about. I don't claim the stuff is mine. It really lightens the load. Okay. So in other traditions, there's very different practices. So I practiced Zen for a long time. There is what's called Shikantaza, which usually gets translated as silent illumination. Basically, the practice is just to sit with your posture. That's all. You're not doing it. It's just being aware of your posture. And you know, eventually, as you pay attention, there's no inside, no outside. The sense of separation kind of dissolves. So that's a practice. Very direct. In Rinzai Zen, which I did a fair amount of, you do koan practices. So my first koan was, where have you been now? I remember like sprinting from this cabin in a 6,000 foot mountain, doing three prostrations, and then this tough old Zen master sitting there saying, where have you been now? And I went in four times a day for 3 days, 12 times. Ring the bell off. Because what koan practice is doing is asking a question that doesn't have an intellectual answer. It's trying to get you to be right here, right now. That's all there is. That moment or sound, nothing extra. I've told this story. Unfortunately, the person who's told this hardest story 1,000 times isn't here, so I can tell it 1,000 first time. I was going through a period where someone in my family was really having a difficult time. And I remember, and I was really at times struggling with it. I remember walking out the door, putting a key in the lock, and at that moment I realized all there was is the sense of the fingers holding that key and that pressure. That's all that was there. All the other stuff was not there for that moment. Okay. So what I'd like to do is end with a little exercise, another approach. So there's another approach is what you call, I can't come up with the right word right now, inquiry. Okay. So just maybe find a comfortable sitting position. And just think to yourself, I am sitting here. Now drop the here, just I am sitting. Now drop the sitting, just I am. Now drop the am, so just I. Now drop the I. Just maybe explore what's here right now. Maybe to ask, what is here now if there is no problem to solve? Just in an embodied sense, ask, who or what is experiencing? What is here when there is nowhere to go and nothing to do? Nothing to go, to know or create or become. So what qualities are here now? No problem, no one to solve, nothing to know. And ready, when you're ready, you can open your eyes and open up to discussion. Anything that have to do with suffering at its end is a relevant question.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.